books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show made in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and today let's hear from some past winners of the Booker Prize as we find out who is on the 2025 shortlist. Coming up, Shehan Kalanatilaka, Paul Lynch, Douglas Stewart, Margaret Atwood, and Bernardine Evaristo, plus some book recommendations from last year's winner, Sam Harvey. That's all coming up in today's Read On. The 2025 Booker shortlist was announced at the end of September. The books are Flashlight by Susan Choi, The Loneliness of Sonia and Sonny by Kiran Desai, Audition by Katie Kitamura, The Rest of Our Lives by Ben Markowitz, The Land in Winter by Andrew Miller, and Flesh by David Salley. And we'll hopefully have interviews with them all soon. But today, let's hear from some past winners. From his home in Sri Lanka, here's Shehan Kalanatilaka.
RNIB has worked with the Booker Prize Foundation for over a decade to ensure that some of the best novels are made available to blind and partially sighted people. Book titles are not always automatically produced in alternative reading formats such as audio or braille, which means that people with sight loss often have to wait much longer to get hold of the latest and most popular books. With funding from the Booker Prize Foundation, we make sure the shortlisted titles in the Booker Prize are produced in all formats as close to the shortlist announcement as is possible. On that shortlist is The Seven Moons of Mali Almeria by Shehan Kalanatilaka, Colombo in Sri Lanka in 1990. Mali Almeria, war photographer, gambler and closet gay, has woken up dead in what seems like a celestial visa office. He has no idea who killed him, and the list of suspects is depressingly long. He has seven moons to try and contact the people he loves most and lead them to a hidden cache of photos that will rock Sri Lanka. The audio version is being read by Benjamin Alawari, and we'll have a clip as soon as we can. But for now, I ask Shehan to tell me about the book.
Where to start? Well, it was 7 years in the making, and it began, I just wanted to write a ghost story, and then it evolved into what it is. But in a nutshell, it's a ghost trying to solve their own murder. So it's a whodunit. And the ghost in question is a murdered journalist, Mali Almeida, from the title, murdered in 1989. And the fact is, he was a war photographer who strung for all the different factions. And of course, Sri Lanka was quite a complex quite a volatile political situation in 89. There were various factions, quite a complicated thing, but the book sort of resolves it quite early on, explains who the various factions were. But this was the premise of it. Mali Almeida was taking photographs for all sides and then ends up dead. And so he has 7 days or seven moons to find out who killed him. It digresses and goes on to lots of other places to deal with Sri Lankan politics and history and mythology and so on. But at the heart of it, it's a ghost trying to solve their own murder.
A political satire or a murder mystery or somewhere in between?
I always set out to write murder mysteries. My first book I thought was a detective story, but I kind of get sidetracked with it. Satire, I wonder about satire. I think because there's jokes in it and there's humor in it. But a lot of the time I'm just describing absurd situations that happen in Sri Lanka. And, you know, if you saw the recent revolution and the images of people jumping in the president's pool and on his bed, the absurdity is something part of the Sri Lankan tragedy. So I question whether it's satire, because a lot of things I'm describing are things that actually happen. It's just, they just seem completely ridiculous. I suppose because there is a lot of humor in the way it's described and the way the story is told and with the characters, perhaps, yeah, it gets mistaken for satire. And I guess there is element of it.
In the book, and both in Sri Lanka in general, is humor used as a kind of coping mechanism?
Well, that's been my thesis of late, and I guess throughout it, because While we've had a very grim history in the last, I mean, in my lifetime, it's not a miserable place. It's not a dour, depressing place. Anyone who's visited, anyone who lives there knows it's quite a cheerful, and even during the crisis, during the revolution, with these long petrol queues, and the people have had to suffer a lot, I just noticed that online, the memes and the satire online, and just standing in the petrol queue, people cry. It just seems like, yeah, we tend to do this a lot. I suppose I overdid it when I've been writing these sort of funny novels that are dealing with these grim topics. But yeah, I believe it is. But then, you know, I don't think that's something to be celebrated. I think in the end, we need serious solutions to serious situations. And I kind of have written to that effect. But yeah, it is true that we tend to crack jokes and crack a smile even in the most awkward of situations.
And we learn that I don't want to call it chaos, but let's, for want of a better word, let's say that chaos also manifests itself within the afterlife as well, or the seven moons.
Yeah, chaos is a very good word, a very apt description. And I think there is this myth that, or maybe this belief that we, this thing that we tell ourselves that when you breathe your last, when you die, you breathe your last, and then suddenly all is revealed. Everything, the universe, everything makes sense when you open your eyes. And that's a comforting thought, but it seems more realistic that there's just as much confusion when you open your eyes. And that seemed to be the case when I was constructing an afterlife or vision of the afterlife for Sri Lanka. It just seemed that, yes, these spirits are wandering around, not quite sure which counter they have to go to go to the next level or what they're supposed to be doing. And perhaps that's the reason why Sri Lanka's experienced so much turmoil decade in, decade out. It's that there are these spirits, restless spirits, some of them quite angry, most of them confused, whispering these bad ideas into people's ears. And that's why these things are happening. It just seemed a plausible enough explanation that the afterlife was chaos and having him navigate that was also part of the story.
Now, Mali's a photographer, and it seems he's trying to bring something good out of the despair and destruction. Is that your philosophy with your writing as well?
I didn't really think about self-identifying, but yeah, you raise a great point. Perhaps Mali's a lot more idealistic than I am. He did believe, because he does very dangerous work. I kind of sit in my room and scribble things. He was out on the front lines photographing the horrors. But he did believe, and he didn't have to. He was a Colombo middle-class kid. He could have stayed in the bubble, which is sort of what I have done, and a lot of people of my background do. He believed that going out and taking these photographs and showing them to the world would make a difference. Do I think a Booker shortlist and a novel being read widely would do that? I'm not sure. I'd like to think maybe so. But yeah, I would say this much, though. The abundance of material and just the fact that these stories, I think that's why a lot of Sri Lankans are writing now and have been for since the 90s, is that they're just these stories that need to be told. And if we don't do it, who will? And I think that's more my attitude, that there's just, as a writer, there's so much material and so much absurdity to mine that I'm doing that. Whether I believe that the box under my bed is going to change Sri Lanka, yeah, I'm not so sure.
How different is Sri Lanka in the 80s to how it is now?
Those comparisons have been made because we let's face it, we have been on the brink of, and some would say have fallen over the edge into the abyss of economic crisis. And it's less the futures. A sense of normalcy is there then that wasn't there when the book came out in late July, early August. But I don't think you can really make a comparison with the 80s. The 80s, I was a teenager growing up during that time. And so I maybe didn't have the full awareness of what was going on. But having studied it, I know there was a full-blown civil war. There was underground Marxist insurrection. There were government death squads. People would go missing, activists, journalists. I don't think we're nowhere near there at the moment. People are struggling, yes, and people are being pushed into poverty, and there is a lot of desperation, but I don't think we're quite at the stage where we're at each other's throats. And I think that's something to be grateful for. And I was writing this book as a piece of history, and I hope it stays that way. I don't think we're anywhere near that level of grimness. And there's hope. There's hope at the moment that things have stabilized and that we can climb our way out of this.
One thing we don't get when we download the audio version is the cover. Can you give us a bit of an audio description of the cover and what it represents?
My experience with covers is it usually takes a few rounds and, it takes a lot of dissatisfaction and a lot of tense meetings before you get something that you like. And that's part of the process. But in this case, it was just the first go. And there wasn't a lot of dialogue. I think he just read the book and maybe saw some of my notes. But yeah, it's a Sri Lankan devil mask, which is used as a tourist symbol of Sri Lanka, but it also has a deeper meaning. It's used in exorcisms and all these spiritual events. So this is a new abstract reading of a devil mask. And the colors, they're wonderfully striking, blues and greens and reds, which aren't quite the palette of a traditional Sri Lankan devil mask. It's almost graphic and it's got some sinister edge to it. I just think it perfectly captures the tone of the book, where it's sort of a bit unnerving. It does draw you in, but also it seems sort of goofy in a way. So I don't know if I did justice to that, but it's certainly a striking cover.
Now, did the name change for the UK release of this book?
That's a bit of a curious story, and I don't really know where to start with that. But it had an earlier life as a man, so you can see some poetic thing with the theme of rebirth. But it was called Chats with the Dead when it came out in the subcontinent. That was the original title. But I think it really struggled to find publishers outside of the Indian subcontinent, where the experience of 89, Sri Lankan mythology, Eastern mythology, and the Sri Lankan political situation was familiar. I think where readers weren't familiar, and especially publishers, it took a while to find an audience, even to find a publisher. So I think once I found Sort of Books, and they very kindly agreed to take on the book, we did agree that it needed to be made accessible to an uninitiated audience who knew nothing about Sri Lanka. And that was my brief to myself when I wrote the first book, Chinaman, which is a book about a Sri Lankan left-arm spinner. Again, if you know nothing about Sri Lanka or cricket, you should be able to enjoy that book, and similar brief here. So that's where it began. We were just going to clarify things and iron things out. But then the pandemic came along, and so publishing deadline got pushed back. And so when suddenly you find yourself, you've got another 9 months or 18 months and your editor and the writer, you're going to keep tinkering. And I think we ended up tinkering more than we expected. And so therefore, it seemed that a new title was more apt, because this was, even though it's the same book, essentially, I think it's benefited from 2 years of tinkering and discarding and shuffling around.
Now, you mentioned your publisher Sort of Books. What was it like being shortlisted, both for yourself and for them?
Yeah, well, I also, you got to realize it was happening. So it was quite a long struggle to get this book to the printers and out. So that was the big victory, and I was celebrating that. And I knew it was coming out in August, but we were over here too distracted with the struggle and the Aragalia. In July 9th was when the whole country came onto the streets and overthrew the president. And so I was just, and I knew this thing was coming out. And then, yes, while my wife was in a petrol queue and I was walking my kids to their class, because there was no petrol, this call comes from a very excited, and, my publishers, like Natanya and Mark, they're very English. So it's, very polite and very measured and calm usually, especially during the grueling editing process. I was the one getting emotional, and they sort of calmly when you do it. And so, yeah, to hear them animated was quite something. And they were ecstatic, and they were like, yeah, we made it to the long list. And so that was, it took a while to sink in, because I'm in this surreal situation. And since then, the ride's been great. It's been busy since then. And, I've got to be grateful. The book has got a lot of attention, which maybe a political satire about Sri Lanka in the 80s may not have got if it had just been another book that had come out. But with the book or not, I've been quite busy, and it's been a great ride.
Now, the audio version, is it recorded yet, the audio version?
Yeah, Benjamin Aluvihare, yes. I spoke with him. I mean, this is all, everything's happening very fast. And what are we, the 7th or the 8th? Yeah, I think it's being recorded as we speak, because I know I'm getting lots of queries on pronunciation. That's the problem with this book. I didn't realize how much you. So, yeah. So I think that informed, okay, narrator, because, yeah, let's face it, even someone from an Indian or Pakistani reader will mangle a lot of Sri Lankan names. So I was pretty certain that it had to be a Sri Lankan, someone who had at least knew the Sri Lankan names. So that was the first thing. And Benjamin, I had seen him as a theater actor in Sri Lanka, and he had played in this play, The One Who Loves You So, by Arun Velindave Premathilaka. It's a story about Grindr. So it's a kind of this modern gay relationship, but it's in this modern Grindr generation, which is, but I was also writing about a gay relationship in a much more closeted time, the 80s. So that fit was amazing. And I knew that he would know the character, and he grew up here, so he'd know the situation. So yeah, certainly, I think Bolinda, that was the thing. I gave them a detailed brief, and they really have been true to what my requirements, and you know, listened to my ideas on this, which has been great. But yeah, I haven't heard anything, so I'm as excited as everyone else. But yeah, I think we record as we speak, and I think you will get your recording before this airs.
Now, as we say, it's been recorded in audio, and RNIB are making the Braille version of it just now. Is it important it's available in different formats so people can enjoy it no matter what their relationship is with print?
Yeah, now, this is all new territory for me, because my first book came out 10 years ago, and it didn't... I think it was seen as the strange cricket book from Sri Lanka. And so if you're interested in Sri Lankan cricket, it'll, you know, you read it, and it found an audience outside, but it didn't really translate that much. As far as I know, there wasn't any audio sales or anything like that. So this is wonderful that I'm the translation sales, the audiobook and the Braille version. But yeah, this is all new territory for me. So it's quite exciting. Look, as a writer sitting in your bedroom in a Sri Lanka that's collapsing, the idea that your story is going to be read beyond mediums, beyond print, is something you don't even dare think about. You're just happy if it gets read in India or Bangladesh or Pakistan, which is the sites I kind of set myself for the first book. So yeah, it's a wonderful thing, and I am quite delighted with how the book seems to have travelled so far in a short time.
The Seven Moons of Mali Almedia is available in print and as an ebook commercially, and available in Braille from RNIB. It will be available in audio both from RNIB and commercially soon. And Chihan, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Robert. Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Talking books on RNIB Connect Radio.
My love of reading is very great, and the pleasure I have derived from books is very great.
Author, actor and creator of Downton Abbey, Julian Fellowes, on why he supports talking books.
This whole business of talking books matters to me. Reading is everything. You know, when you're blind, reading is travel. Reading is the last way that you can still enjoy certain things that are no longer realistic for a blind person to enjoy autonomously. It is an absolute lifeline, and we can help them keep that lifeline going.
For more information on the Talking Book service and how to support it, head to rnib.org.uk. On today's Read On, we're hearing from past winners of the Booker Prize. And in 2020, that honour went to Douglas Stewart and his book, Shuggy Bain. Here he is, talking to Red Sail.
Hi Red, how are you?
Very well, thank you. And many congratulations on being shortlisted for the Booker Prize this year.
Ah, thank you very much. Yeah, it is such a huge honour.
You are one of four debut novelists on the list. It must have come as quite a surprise.
It certainly did come as a surprise. You know, as a debut novelist, I spent most of my time worrying if my book would actually be published, never mind recognised on any prize list. It took me about 10 years to write Shuggy Bain. And actually, when my agent was sending it out for submission, it was rejected about 32 times. And so to actually see it on a prize list, even when it made the long list, I was just really floored.
And it's also being translated into at least 11 languages so far as well.
Actually, as of today, it's about 22 languages, I think, or it's certainly creeping up there. Croatia was the latest, which is really fantastic. And then also for a book that is written in quite broad Scots, it'll actually be in both Korean and Japanese, which blows my mind.
It's very much located in Glasgow in the 1980s. But for anybody who hasn't had the pleasure of picking it up yet, could you just give us a quick introduction to the story?
Absolutely. Shuggie Bane is actually a portrait of the Bane family who are living in 1980s Glasgow. It is a love story at its heart, but it is the love story that looks at how children can have a very unconditional, tenacious love for parents who are a little bit flawed or who are suffering with addiction. We follow the mother of the family, Agnes Bane, who is a very beautiful, driven, ambitious, but a little bit proud and a little bit vain mother. And as her marriage is starting to come apart, she finds herself slipping into alcoholism. At the beginning of the book, everyone sort of thinks of Agnes as being too much. She is too much. She's exhausting. But actually, it's not that Agnes is too much. It's that the world around her is not enough. And so after she is sort of abandoned by her husband in a coal mining town that is similarly being shut down by the Thatcher government, she starts to slide into her addiction. And it is her three children, Catherine, Leek, and then the baby of the family, Shuggie, who stay by her side and try to save their mother from herself. Now, as Agnes is a little bit isolated, Shuggie, her youngest son, is also isolated because although he's a very young boy, he is growing up to be not like the other boys. And everyone around him very quickly identifies him as no right, as what they say in the book, just meaning he's very sort of precocious. He's a little bit effeminate. And so it's really this lovely portrait of love and how people cling to each other to survive as Agnes and Shuggie try to make their way through the world.
We follow the Bane family over the period of a decade as they disintegrate. Yet that bond between Shuggie and Agnes becomes stronger and stronger. At times, I did wonder why the book wasn't called Agnes Bane. She is the linchpin of the story. Is it because Shuggie is the survivor that he takes the title role?
Yeah, that's exactly it, Red. I think children are always the hope of their parents. And because the book looks a lot at 1980s Glasgow, but also, as you say, about 40 years in the history of the city, we see people go through an awfully difficult time. And we are pitched towards, as the reader, thinking about what the future might be. And Shuggie in that relationship is the future. Agnes's fate, and I don't mean to sort of spring it on the reader, so I almost reveal it from the very first chapter, is she is doomed. She is in a really difficult position. And so Shuggie for me is the little part of her that goes on and continues into the future. But even Glasgow itself is a character in the book, and I wanted really to show that. It was an incredibly difficult time in the city when the book is set. You know, the Thatcher government dismantled a lot of heavy industry, which was the main employer of a lot of working class men. And we saw unemployment skyrocket up into the 20% and stay there for quite a long time. And so even as I was writing the book and thinking about what was happening socially, I hoped that there was enough hope in the book to make you hope. I hope there was enough hope for Shuggie's generation that was to come. As a writer, one of my pleasures is actually writing dialogue. And I couldn't imagine writing a book about Glasgow without really leaning into Broad Scots or the Glaswegian dialect. I find it really sort of expressive and funny and oftentimes quite unsettling how sentences can go together. They can be incredibly tender, but they sound incredibly brutal, or they can be very sad, but they're incredibly funny. And so that was one of the great pleasures of writing the book. But the book actually has lots of different layers in it because, as I said earlier, the main character of Agnes Bane is sort of affecting airs and graces. She's not letting her neighbours, who she's absolutely identical to, believe that she is struggling in the same way that they are. And so she speaks in a very standard English or a very Queen's English because she wants to be perceived as above her neighbours. And so I even love the different levels of that and how that creates tension and how that creates separation between people who are identical. But when I first wrote the book, I wasn't thinking about the gaze of anyone else. I was thinking about writing it in honor of the people that I was writing about. And so in order to do that, you write with as much honesty as you can, and you write it as truthfully to the Glaswegian dialect as you can manage.
Well, the book has been wonderfully brought to life by Angus King, who really captures all those separate voices.
He'd worked for Kilfeathers for over a year. It was never meant to be that long. It was just that he had to feed himself and pay his own dig money each week, and the supermarket was the only business that would take him. Mr. Culfeather was a parsimonious bastard. He liked to staff the shop with anyone he didn't have to pay a full adult wage, and Shuggy found himself able to take short shifts that fit around his patchy schooling. In his dreams, he always intended to move on. He had always loved to brush and play with hair. It was the only thing that made time truly fly. When he had turned 16, he had promised himself he would go to the hairdressing college that sat south of the River Clyde. He had gathered up all of his inspiration, the sketches he had copied from the Littlewoods catalogue and pages ripped from the Sunday magazines. Then he had gone to Cardonald to see about the evening classes. At the bus stop outside the college, he alighted with half a dozen 18-year-olds. They wore the newest, most fashionable gear and talked with a buzzing confidence that masked their own nerves. Shuggy walked half as fast as they did. He watched them go in the front door, then he recrossed the street to catch the bus going the other way. He started at Kilfeather's the following week.
Angus King, narrating Shuggy Bane, written by my guest, Douglas Stewart. Did you have anything to do with the selection of Angus King as the narrator of the book?
Oh, I was incredibly fortunate to have a role in the selection of the narrator of the book. My publisher actually sent me three options and three really fantastic readers. But Angus stuck out to me because he had such an expressive voice, and the book is populated by a real chorus of characters and also a lot of women. And I could tell just from the little clip that was submitted to me that he would be able to capture all the different levels of that and really bring them to life. You know, I think most writers, if they can, would love to narrate their own books. And I've certainly narrated a lot of my own short stories that were published in The New Yorker. But I just knew this task was beyond me because there are so many characters in the book. Because I think that's part of writing about working class Glasgow. You know, it's a collective moment. That how he remembers all of their inflections and their tones and their little tics and how they speak is really remarkable.
Blind and partially sighted readers are very fortunate that, because of the support of the Booker Foundation, accessible copies, including the audiobook version, have been made available to the RNIB library. One thing, unfortunately, we can't appreciate is the cover. So, for a blind audience, could you just describe the cover of the book?
Oh, it would be my honour. The cover of the book was actually a photograph that I chose myself. I was very fortunate to have a supportive publisher in that also. But it was a photograph that was taken in the 1980s, and it is of a little boy who is on the Easter House housing scheme in the East End of Glasgow. And in the background of the photograph are these very low council house flats. They're about four stories, but they're already falling into disrepair. It's very clear. And then as you sort of come into the foreground, there's sort of waste ground that is strewn with litter and just abandoned debris from the homes that surround it. And I should say it's a black and white photograph. In the very foreground is a washing pole that shoots straight up in the sky and then comes out into a T-bar at the top. And at the very top of that washing pole is a young boy who has climbed it to the very top. And he's gazing out across the landscape, gazing beyond the gaze of the reader. And there's a slight hope in his eyes and how he's looking into the far distance. But the photo can't also help but reference a crucifixion, the way he's holding on to the T-bar. But there's also a real sensitivity, and I wouldn't say he was an effeminate boy, but the way he's holding on to the bar and sort of cuddling it also lets you know that he is quite a tender soul. And then my publishers did a beautiful job where they take this bleak social photograph, but then they place in very bold, iconic letters over the top of it the title Shuggy Bane, which is in the most luminous gold foil. So it's quite a dazzling thing to behold and very, very striking.
Well, Douglas Stewart, thank you so much for taking us further into the world of Shuggy Bane, and many congratulations on being shortlisted for this year's Booker Prize.
Thank you very much, Red, and thank you for having me.
Like all the books shortlisted for this and previous year's Booker Prizes, Shuggy Bane is available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB Library, thanks to the generous support of the Booker Foundation.
And let's stay with Red Sail as we revisit the controversial winner, or rather winners, from 2019.
There was a dramatic plot twist to the Booker Prize this week.
To gasps of astonishment from the dinner guest gathered at London's Guildhall, Chair of Judges Peter Florence announced that the jury was flouting the rules and there would be two winners this year. He and the four other judges could not decide between The Testaments by Margaret Atwood and Girl, Woman, Other by Bernardine Evaristo. And so the £50,000 prize and the title of winner of the 2019 Booker Prize would be shared between the two authors. Whilst both were clearly delighted, Margaret Atwood admitted that she was very surprised and didn't really need the attention, or indeed the money, which she will be donating to a charity for Indigenous authors in Canada. Bernardine Evaristo, who became the first black woman to win the prize in its 51-year history, said she hoped it would inspire others. She plans to use her prize money to pay off her mortgage. It's not the first time the prize has been shared. But after the second time in 1992, when The English Patient by Michael Ondaatje and Sacred Hunger by Barry Unsworth shared the honours, the organisers changed the rules so that only one winner could be chosen. However, in a move that he said was inspired by the Extinction Rebellion protests taking place just up the road from Guildhall, Chair of Judges Peter Florence and the jury effectively staged a sit-in, refusing to choose between the two novels. We've had both Margaret Atwood and Bernardine Evaristo on the show during the last few weeks, and you can hear the full interviews by heading to our Audio Boom page. But here's a taste of both Margaret Atwood and Bernardine Evaristo's books and what they have to say about them.
It's called Girl, Woman, Other, and it's about 12 primarily black British women, and they are aged 19 to 93. And they come from different cultural backgrounds. They are of different classes and sexualities. They have different occupations. They are of different generations, obviously, because they're aged 19 to 93. And what I wanted to do with the novel was to explore a wider expanse of black British womanhood than we would normally encounter in fiction. So I call the novel a fusion fiction in the sense that each woman has her own section, but all the stories in some way or other are fused with each other's stories. So I have four mothers and daughters in the novel, and I have women who are also friends of some of the leading characters and also colleagues. And the overall effect is this interlinked network of women who in some way are related to or shaped by or inform each other. And it was 5 years in the writing. And I called it Girl, Woman, Other because, apart from one character who's no longer living, with each woman, we meet her in the novel at the age she is when the novel opens, which is in contemporary society today. But we also go back into their past and childhoods to a greater or lesser extent. So we see the women as women, we see them as girls. And the reason I called it other is because often women are othered in society. Black women are definitely othered in society. But the women are also othered maybe because of their class or because of their sexuality or because of the country that they might have come from. And the women also other each other in the sense that they're not all necessarily going to approve of each other. So there are a couple of characters who you might consider to be homophobic, and then there are characters who are on the homosexual spectrum. So it's a novel full of lots of different things going on.
Amma takes a sip of her Americano, with its customary Kickstarter extra shot in it, as she approaches the brutalist grey arts complex ahead. At least they try to enliven the bunker-like concrete with neon light displays these days, and the venue has a reputation for being progressive rather than traditionalist. Years ago, she expected to be evicted as soon as she dared walk through its doors, a time when people really did wear their smartest clothes to go to the theatre and look down their noses at those not in proper attire. She wants people to bring their curiosity to her plays, doesn't give a damn what they wear, as her own sod-you style anyway, which has evolved, it's true, away from the cliché denim dungarees, Che Guevara beret, PLO scarf and ever-present badge of two interlocked female symbols. Talk about wearing your heart on your sleeve, girl. These days she wears silver or gold trainers in winter, fail-self Birkies in summer. Winter, it's black slacks, either baggy or tight, depending on whether she's a size 12 or 14 that week, a size smaller on top. Summer, it's pattern harem pants that end just below the knee. Winter, it's bright asymmetric shirts, jumpers, jackets, coats. Year-round, her peroxide dreadlocks are trained to stick up like candles on a birthday cake. Silver hoop earrings, chunky African bangles, and pink lipstick are her perennial signature style statement.
Anna Maria Nabiri narrating Girl, Woman, Other, written by Bernardine Evaristo. Few books have been as eagerly anticipated as The Testaments, Margaret Atwood's sequel to her 1985 novel, The Handmaid's Tale. Its publication came with a fanfare reminiscent of that given to Harry Potter, with bookshops opening at midnight and costumed characters from the book mingling with fans eager to get their hands on a copy.
First of all, yes, there had been many requests for a sequel, which I'd always said no to, because I understood it to mean that it would be a continuation of the narrative voice of Alfred in The Handmaid's Tale, and there was no way I could recreate that. However, as time moved on, and instead of moving further away from Gilead, we started moving towards it, particularly in the United States, I re-examined that position and decided that although I could not continue with the story of Alfred, I could continue with three other people concerned in these events and tell the story of the beginning of the end. Because we know from The Handmaid's Tale that Gilead vanishes. It's no longer present 200 years into the future because they're having a symposium on it. And we know that when they're having a symposium on something, it's done. It's over. So how did it collapse? How do these kinds of regimes disappear? And they can disappear in various ways. So I was interested in exploring that, and also in exploring what it would be like for the second generation. Because second generations in revolutionary regimes are quite different from first generation.
And it's all that they know.
That's all they know. That's normal life to them. But also they're not engaged in the violent part of the affair. A form of order has been restored. There's some way in which this thing functions, and that's what they grow up within. So one of the narrators grows up within Gilead. One of them grows up across the border in the place where you escape to when things go pear-shaped in the United States, and that would be Canada.
We're all ready to go.
It has always been that way. And therefore, we see Gilead from within, from without, and from a founder.
Only dead people are allowed to have statues, but I have been given one while still alive. Already, I am petrified. This statue was a small token of appreciation for my many contributions, said the citation, which was read out by Aunt Vidala. She'd been assigned the task by our superiors and was far from appreciative. I thanked her with as much modesty as I could summon, then pulled the rope that released the cloth drape shrouding me. It billowed to the ground, and there I stood. We don't do cheering here at Ardua Hall, but there was some discreet clapping. I inclined my head in a nod. My statue is larger than life, as statues tend to be, and shows me as younger, slimmer, and in better shape than I've been for some time. I am standing straight, shoulders back, my lips curved into a firm but benevolent smile. My eyes are fixed on some cosmic point of reference, understood to represent my idealism, my unflinching commitment to duty, my determination to move forward despite all obstacles. Not that anything in the sky would be visible to my statue, placed as it is in a morose cluster of trees and shrubs beside the footpath running in front of Ardua Hall. We aunts must not be too presumptuous, even in stone. Clutching my left hand is a girl of 7 or 8, gazing up at me with trusting eyes. My right hand rests on the head of a woman crouched at my side, her hair veiled, her eyes upturned in an expression that could be read as either craven or grateful. One of our handmaids, and behind me is one of my pearl girls, ready to set out on her missionary work. Hanging from a belt around my waist is my taser. This weapon reminds me of my failings. Had I been more effective, I would not have needed such an implement. The persuasion in my voice would have been enough. As a group of statuary, it's not a great success. Too crowded. I would have preferred more emphasis on myself. But at least I look sane. It could well have been otherwise, as the elderly sculptress, a true believer since deceased, had a tendency to confer bulging eyes on her subjects as a sign of their pious fervor. Her bust of Aunt Helena looks rabid, that of Aunt Vidala is hyperthyroid, and that of Aunt Elizabeth appears ready to explode. At the unveiling, the sculptress was nervous. Was her rendition of me sufficiently flattering? Did I approve of it? Would I be seen to approve? I toyed with the idea of frowning as the sheet came off, but thought better of it. I am not without compassion. Very lifelike, I said. That was 9 years ago. Since then, my statue has weathered. Pigeons have decorated me. Moss has sprouted in my damper crevices. Votaries have taken to leaving offerings at my feet. Eggs for fertility. Oranges to suggest the fullness of pregnancy. Croissants to reference the moon. I ignore the breadstuffs. Usually they have been rained on. But pocket the oranges. Oranges are so refreshing.
The Testaments by Margaret Atwood is available now from the RNIB Library in Braille, giant print, and as TB24921.
Escape into the world of great literature with Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio. Every weekday at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m, hear from a complete unabridged classic from the RNIB Library, beautifully narrated and specially selected for blind and partially sighted listeners. From timeless adventures to literary masterpieces, these serialised audiobooks let you enjoy a new chapter every day. And for younger listeners, don't miss Children's Talking Books every Saturday at 9 a.m. Perfect for the young at heart, and for sparking imaginations. Talking Books, every weekday at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m, only on RNIB Connect Radio.
This is an RNIB Talking Book.
History of the Talking Book Service and Studios. Back in the days of recording to tape, sometimes the narrators were asked to go a little bit faster.
We looked at the tape, we looked at the book, we looked at the amount of tape we had, and I said, look, there's a chapter heading coming up in a page and a half's time, you've got 3 minutes, can you speed up a little bit? We're not going, it wasn't quite that bad, but we did tend to try and speed up a little bit.
Today, RNIB Talking Books are part of the RNIB National Library Service, offering books in audio, braille and giant print, along with many other benefits such as braille music scores, giant print sheet music, online forums and much more. Joining is simple. If you're eligible to join, call 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk. That's 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
On today's Read On, we are hearing from past winners of the Booker Prize, and in 2023, it was won by Paul Lynch. RNIB is very proud to work with the Booker Prize Foundation to ensure titles in the Booker Prize are available in accessible formats for everyone to enjoy. The prize was established in 1969 as a literary prize awarded annually for the best original novel written in English and published in the UK. Former winners include Iris Murdoch, Salman Rushdie, Ian McEwan and Hilary Mantel. RNIB has worked with the Booker Prize Foundation for over a decade to ensure that some of the year's best novels are made available to blind and partially sighted people. Book titles are not always automatically produced in alternative reading formats, such as audio or braille, which means that people with sight loss often have to wait longer to get hold of the latest and most popular books. And now the wait is over. The winner of the Booker Prize 2023 was announced at a ceremony on Sunday evening, and the winner is Paul Lynch for his book Prophet Song. Set in a dystopian Ireland, Paul Lynch's book Prophet Song sees the country falling apart and in the grip of a government turning towards tyranny, and finds us caught within the nightmare logic of a society that is quickly unravelling. A devastating vision of a country at war, and a deeply human portrait of a mother's fight to hold her family together. I'll speak to author Paul Lynch in a moment, but for now the audio version of Prophet Song is read by Gerry O'Brien.
There's nothing to worry about, Mrs. Stack.
Why should I be worried, Carter?
Yes, indeed, Mrs. Stack. We don't want to be taking up any more of your time, and aren't we damp enough this evening making calls? It'll be hard work getting ourselves dry by the heater in the car. She slides the patio door closed, holding the card in her hand, watching the two men return to the car, watching the car move up the street. It brakes for the junction, and its taillights intensify, taking the look of two eyes agleam. She looks once more onto the street, returned to an evening's quiet. The heat from the hall as she steps inside and shuts the front door, and then she stands a moment, examining the card, and finds she has been holding her breath. This feeling now that something has come into the house. She wants to put the baby down. She wants to stand and think, seeing how it stood with the two men and came into the hallway of its own accord. Something formless yet felt. She can sense it skulking alongside her as she steps through the living room past the children.
Prophet Song is a novel that centers around Eilish Stack, who is a woman in her 40s living in Dublin, a Dublin that seems just like Dublin now, certainly when the book opens. It seems like our present moment. She's got four kids, three teenagers, and a surprise infant that's come along recently. She's married to Larry, who works for the Teachers Union of Ireland. So he's a trade unionist. And when the book opens, Eilish, who's a scientist herself, opens the front door to find two officers from Ireland's newly formed GNSB, the Garda National Services Bureau, who want to speak to her husband, Larry, and he's not at home. And this is the moment at which, I suppose, in many ways, you might say that she enters the labyrinth. It's the moment at which Ireland's newly formed secret police want to speak to her husband. And Dublin is, how do I put this? Dublin is at the same time not Dublin. It's a place where a populist government has been elected, where the democratic norms are beginning to slide and the government is sort of reaching its hand around and taking away things that might be considered normal in a liberal democracy. The media is starting to be controlled. The economy is starting to shrink. Multinationals are starting to pull out. And all along, there's this sense among the people who are in this world, they're saying to each other, but this can't happen here. This can't be allowed to happen. But it is happening. And that's what Prophet Song is about.
With thanks to the Booker Foundation. The full interview with Paul Lynch can be found on the Read On podcast feed. Just type Read On, RNIB, in your favourite podcast app. For more information and to join RNIB Library, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
And finally, on today's show, let's hear some book recommendations from last year's Booker winner, Samantha Harvey. Is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading?
Gosh, there are loads. It's hard to narrow it down. if I've been asked this before, I've mentioned Danny, the Champion of the World, which certainly was one of the books that I remember reading on my own and absolutely loving. Another was Goodnight, Mr. Tom, which I remember reading sort of on my own and being devastated. It's a very sad book, being really devastated by it, but also understanding at some level the incredible power of reading. So probably those two would be my pick.
Yes, said Tom bluntly on opening the front door. What do you want? A harassed, middle-aged woman in a green coat and felt hat stood on his step. She glanced at the armband on her sleeve. She gave him an awkward smile. I'm the billeting officer for this area, she began.
Oh, yes? And what's that got to do with me?
She flushed slightly. Well, Mr. Oakley. Thomas Oakley. Ah, thank you, Mr. Oakley. She paused and took a deep breath. Mr. Oakley, with the declaration of war imminent... Tom waved his hand.
I know all that. Get to the point. What do you want?
He noticed a small boy at her side. It's him I've come about, she said. I am on my way to your village hall with the others.
What others?
She stepped to one side. Behind the large iron gate, which stood at the end of the graveyard, were a small group of children. Many of them were filthy and very poorly clad. Only a handful had a blazer or coat. They all looked bewildered and exhausted. One tiny dark-haired girl in the front was hanging firmly onto a new teddy bear. The woman touched the boy at her side and pushed him forward.
There's no need to tell me, said Tom. It's obligatory, and it's for the war effort.
You are entitled to choose your child, I know, began the woman apologetically. Tom gave a snort. But, she continued, his mother wants him to be with someone who's religious or near a church. She was quite adamant. Said she would only let him be evacuated if he was.
Was what?
Asked Tom impatiently.
Near a church.
That's Christopher Saul reading from Goodnight, Mr. Tom by Michelle McGorian. Available from RNIB Talking Books, as is Roald Dahl's Danny, Champion of the World. And is there a book on a rainy day you could happily cuddle up with and reread?
Well, there are loads, but in terms of sort of comfort reading, I really like the Winston Graham Poldark books. I first read them when I was in my early teens, and there are lots of them, maybe at least 12. It's just brilliant historical fiction, Hardy-esque at times. He writes so beautifully. And so I have been working my way very slowly through the series again. I think I'm on book number 7 or 8 at the moment. So those are books that I really like to come back to.
Joshua Poldark died in March 1783. In February of that year, feeling that his tenure was becoming short, he sent for his brother from Trenwith. Charles came lolloping over on his great roan horse one cold grey afternoon, and Prudy Painter, lank-haired and dark-faced and fat, showed him straight into the bedroom where Joshua lay posed up with pillows and cushions in the big box bed. Charles looked askance round the room with his small, watery blue eyes at the disorder and the dirt, then lifted his coat-tails and subsided upon a wicker chair which creaked under his weight.
"Well, Joshua." "Well, Charles. This is a bad business. Bad indeed. When will you be about again, do you think? There's no telling. I fancy the churchyard will have a strong pull."
Charles thrust out his bottom lip. He would have discounted the remark if he had not had word to the contrary. He hiccuped a little. Riding always gave him indigestion these days, and was heartily reassuring.
"Nonsense, man. The gout in the legs never killed nobody. It's when it gets up to the head that it's dangerous. Choke tells me different, that there is other cause for the swelling. For once, I misdoubt if the old fool is not right. Though in God's truth, by all appearance, 'tis you that should be lying here, since I'm but half your size.
That's Stephen Jack reading from Ross Poldark, a novel of Cornwall by Winston Graham, the first in the Poldark series, available from RNIB Talking Books. And is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be contemporary, but some you've read recently, it's fresh in the mind, you'd like to recommend?
Yeah, I would probably recommend The Friend by Sigrid Nunes. I read it about a month ago. It's partly about a woman's relationship with a dog she inherits from a friend who's died. And it's a very beautiful book about that relationship, but also her relationship with her friend who's passed away. So maybe because I'm in a doggy sort of dog frame of mind at the moment, it spoke to me. But it's a really wonderful, strange, unconventional, beautiful, moving book.
There were two errors in your obituary. The date you moved from London to New York, off by 1 year. Misspelling of the maiden name of wife one. Small errors, which were later corrected, but which we all knew would have annoyed the hell out of you. But at your memorial, I overheard something that would have amused you. I wish I could pray. What's stopping you? He is. Would have, would have. The dead dwell in the conditional, tense of the unreal. But there is also the extraordinary sense that you have become omniscient, that nothing we do or think or feel can be kept from you. The extraordinary sense that you are reading these words, that you know what they'll say even before I write them.
That's Hilary Huber reading from The Friend by Sigrid Nunes, available commercially now. And once again, Sam, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robert. It's my pleasure.
That's all we've got time for on today's edition of Read On. We'll be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, there are over 400 episodes available as a podcast. Just search for RNIB Read On. And remember to tune in every weekday at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. for our sister show, Talking Books, where we showcase the best that RNIB Library has to offer that we're allowed to play on air. Listen live or catch up online at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.